So last week, we finished. Those of you who were here, you will remember we finished, well, I finished by talking for the last 20 minutes of the talk about my work with people who have long-term pain and illness and how they live with that every day. They wake up with it in the morning and all through the day they're in pain, and it's going to be like that for the rest of their lives. Sometimes it'll get worse as time goes on. And how they have to somehow come to terms with the fact that they're in pain, and they always will be. In fact, recently, I led a course in a place called Bradford, not Wigan, and one of the women on the course, she recently told me that she was born in pain. She was born in pain, and she's had pain all her life. And her name is Joy. And it's amazing because she is a very, very joyful person, although she is in. I mean, I remember one week she came along to the course. I have to be a bit careful here because I might end up giving this talk on pain and suffering again, but I'll just say this, that she came along to maybe the third or the fourth week of the course, and she didn't look right. And I said to her, "You don't look great." And she said, No, I've had a bad week, I've had a bad week." And then when she came in to report in later, she was just starting to say what a bad week she's had, and then she just started crying and said, "It's okay, it's all right, I'm just crying." And then she carried on. And quite amazing, but she is a very, very joyful person. But there's a book, in fact, called Finding Joy in the Heart of Pain by Darlene Cohen, which is very much about that kind of idea. So last week we saw that people coming along to a course like that learn, what they have to learn is somehow how to come to terms with the situation they're in. And by doing that, coming to terms with the situation they're in, there's a kind of deep shift within them, which allows them to live with their pain. You could almost say that they've become happy within a painful body, finding joy in the heart of pain. But this week's topic is njutning and lycka. And I was preparing for this talk this morning, but I've decided in the last half an hour not to give the talk that I prepared for this morning, because something else occurred to me. And what occurred to me was pleasure and happiness. I've always been a little bit suspicious of pleasure and happiness. I've always felt that in some way, meaning is found in pain and suffering, and that pleasure and happiness are somehow superficial. And I've always preferred sad songs to happy songs. I prefer Beethoven to Mozart. Mozart is just too happy for me. And I prefer dark novels rather than happy novels. And films with grit in them rather than happy films. I don't mind a happy film and a happy novel, but I move towards the dark. I remember when Crosby, Stills and Nash and Young were all the rage, and I remember when Neil Young joined them. First of all, it was just Crosby, Stills and Nash with their first album, then Neil Young joined them, and then one of the other three, I can't remember which one it was, they said that Neil Young joining them meant that they had a bit of weight. And I think that's true, that Neil Young brought with him some depth and some grit. So in the meditation there, I was wondering why it was that I trust pain and suffering, as if there's some kind of meaning there. Whereas happiness and pleasure, I don't quite trust. One of the epithets of the Buddha, he was called many, many things, not just the Buddha, but one of the epithets was Sugata. And Sugata means something like the well gone. But sometimes it's translated as the happy one. And I just noticed that I really don't like that. I don't really like to think of the Buddha as being happy. It seems to somehow take something away from him. This is a kind of confession, really, rather than anything else. So I was wondering why this was, and it became obvious to me in the meditation why, so I thought I'd share it with you. When I was teenage years, my mother and father began not to get on, and we moved to a country away from England, down in the Middle East, and they began to not get on spectacularly. And so life as a teenager was very difficult, very troubled. And then we came back to this country. And some years later, we moved house away from my hometown. And we knew nobody in this new town. And just a few months after we moved there, my mother left my father. And my father came home from work and he said, "Where's your mum?" I had to tell him. I said, "She's gone." And he didn't understand. He said, "Where's she gone?" I said, "She has left. She's gone." And he left the house and he got drunk and he came back drunk. And he stayed drunk. He just stayed drunk. And he had a very responsible job at London Airport as a chief electrical engineer. He was the chief electrical engineer at London Airport. And he... there I was in this house with my father, and I had nobody else around, so I had to deal with this man coming home late at night drunk, getting me out of bed and talking and talking and talking, and eventually I just had to go. I just couldn't take it, so I left. I moved to London, and when I left, sometime later, he lost his job. And then because he lost his job, he also lost his house. And then maybe a year later, he just turned up. I was living in a Buddhist community, and he just turned up with absolutely nothing. Nothing. He lost everything. And we had to take him into the community. Not only had he lost all his house and his job and everything, he'd also lost his mind because he drank so much that his mind was just gone. He was unable to function. So this was when I was still probably maybe about 20 years old when this happened. And of course the whole family just went off in different directions and more or less lost contact with each other for some time. So I'm telling you this because I think that's probably why I distrust the idea of happiness and pleasure, because that's what my parents were into. We went to the Middle East and they wanted to have a really good time. They wanted to party and they drank and dancing, and so everything was supposed to be happy and jolly, but it wasn't. There was some deep darkness underneath it. And there's a song, some of you will know this song. It was an advert, and there were many different adverts, but it was always the same song. It was the martini advert. Do you know the martini advert? "The most beautiful drink in the world. It's the right one, the bright one. It's martini." Do you remember that one? I'm tempted to sing it to you. But... And then... There are other words as well, and these are the ones, really. "Any time, any place, anywhere. There's a wonderful world you can share. It's the right one. It's the bright one. It's martini." And these adverts, there were a whole string of them. Whenever I went to the pictures, there was always a martini advert. And it was always young, beautiful people, very, really beautiful people. Gorgeous complexions and wonderful hair and very expensive clothes. And they were always outside in the sunshine, either at a kind of garden party in a massive mansion Or I remember one on a yacht. They were on this really expensive yacht. And it was only young, beautiful people in this advert, every single martini advert, and they were always singing this same song. And I profoundly disliked it. And then there was another song around that time that my parents used to really like. And it's the only song. You know, my parents used to like Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett and Dean Martin and all those people. But there was one song which still to this day I love. Oh, the good life, full of fun, seems to be the ideal. The good life lets you hide all the sadness you feel. And that's what I felt about the good life, the life of fun and enjoyment. It was somehow letting people hide the sadness they really felt. So I was thinking about that when we were meditating, and I was thinking, here am I just about to give a talk on Njutning and Lykke. What I was going to do, I was going to do a commentary. Like last week, it was more or less a commentary on a sutta called the Salata Sutta, the Sutra of the Two Darts. And I was going to give a commentary on another sutta called the Niramisa Sutta. But I'm not going to do that now. What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about different levels of happiness and pleasure. Because what I distrust about happiness and pleasure, that it's superficial, that it's hiding the realities of the world underneath, and that when people are happy, they're really just hiding things away. So when the Buddha talks about happiness, I find that very challenging. It's a very challenging idea for me. So what I'm going to do is, can I take all this down now? Nothing and liquor, off you go. And we're going to start again with dukkha. So dukkha, as we heard last week, many different levels to this word, but it means pain, suffering, unhappiness, anguish, unease, etc., etc. And I'm going to talk about a path of Buddhism leading to enlightenment that begins with dukkha. And quite a few of you will know this path. It's we refer to it as the spiral path, but there are 12 steps. And the first maybe 7 steps really are a way, well, the whole path. Usually when you hear about the path of Buddhism, either the threefold way or the eightfold path or the five spiritual faculties, it's in terms of what you do. It's in terms of the practices you engage in. That's what make up the path. But this particular way of talking about it is what it feels like from the inside to practice the Dharma, the stages that you go through, the almost the emotional as well as the cognitive stages that you pass through in your spiritual life. It begins with dukkha, which is quite interesting. It's not that you particularly have to suffer a lot before you take up Buddhism, although some people do. It's more that we need to be aware of it. Yeah, you need to have some kind of awareness that life isn't all great. There is another side to life. We prefer to look on the good side of life. We want the good life, full of fun. It seems to be the ideal. This is what we're after. But Buddhism says, wait a minute. There's another side to life. There is such a thing as old age and death and disease and disappointment and grief and betrayal. Those things do exist in the world, and as long as you're human, you are susceptible to them. So you need to take care. You need to take really good care. So dukkha is almost a kind of, at this stage, it's almost like an insight. It's a kind of acknowledging that life can't all be great all the time. We have to accept that fact. Yeah. Interestingly, going back to some of the people who come on courses, Breathworks courses, who have got pain and so on, and I talked also last week about the loss that they experience. It's very interesting to see how they respond, because when I run meditation classes or Buddhism courses at the centre for people who don't have pain and illness, there's a certain level of commitment to the course, but it's not great. It's not a great, you know, I'll say to them, you need to meditate every day for, you know, 10, 15 minutes to begin with. And then they come back next week and I say, have you done that? No, they haven't. Maybe one or two of them have, but on the whole, they haven't done it. Oh, I haven't found the time. But people with pain and illness, you say you have to do these practices for 30, 40 minutes a day, every day. And they do. They really do. And there's a tremendous commitment, because they really need something. They really, really need something to help them come to terms with what life has thrown at them. So, dukkha, an understanding, some kind of understanding, some kind of insight that dukkha really does exist. Yeah. And that leads to faith. Or sometimes it leads to faith. Doesn't always lead to faith. Sometimes people can experience tremendous dukkha and it doesn't lead to faith. They don't know where to go. It leads to despair. In England we pronounce it Kierkegaard, but I'm sure that's not the way you pronounce it, is it? How do you pronounce Kierkegaard? He said the opposite of faith is despair. Usually we think of the opposite of faith being doubt, but he said it's despair, and I think that's a very interesting idea. But you could say that if you have some kind of insight into the fact that life does contain suffering, then it can lead to a deeper kind of engagement with life. And I think that's where the faith comes in. It's this kind of deeper engagement. Okay, so life isn't going to be wonderful all the way through. You know, the pursuit of happiness isn't always possible. So what is life then? So it's almost as if the dukkha causes you to question, causes you to stop and say, wait a minute though, what am I going to do with life? What am I going to do with this life? Considering that it does end with death. And between now and death, there's probably going to be quite a lot of difficulties. As well, of course, of happiness. You know, there are some people I know who experience more happiness than unhappiness. But they still experience unhappiness. So why? What are we going to do with this? And that's where I think faith comes in. One of my favourite authors is a Christian, Wilfred Cantwell Smith, who was a Christian minister and a theologian and scholar of comparative religion, who specialised in Islam. And he said that faith was made up of two aspects, insight and response. Insight and response. And the response was a yes. Yeah. So there's a kind of an insight into life, and then the response was yes. Yeah. So it's that sort of going deeper into life, digging a bit deeper, and then saying yes. And then, this is where we get onto the topic of this evening. After faith comes joy. How does that work? There's a couple of little things here that isn't said in the original sutta from which this came, but sometimes people feel joy immediately on faith. But because of your faith, then you start to really practice. Perhaps the first thing you practice is you look at your ethical life. How ethical am I being? How am I in relation to other people? And then maybe you begin to change. I was talking to an order member at dinner just before the class this evening, and we were talking about, he asked me whether I thought people really changed as a result of finding the Dharma. And I said, what I see is when people come to beginners classes, I see sometimes quite enormous changes very quickly. People just change so quickly. It's quite amazing sometimes. And I think it's because new ideas are coming in, new ways of looking at things. But also because they really take up the practice of ethics. And when you take up the practice of ethics, that really does change you. And when you start becoming ethical, you become a little bit happier. A little bit happier. Your own life circumstances might be quite difficult. But the fact that you're now treating people better than you were naturally begins to make you feel a bit happier. It's quite interesting. When the Buddha was talking about these things, he says that you don't have to try to make joy happen. It happens naturally. Yeah. And each one, as we go through each one, he said, you don't have to try to make the next thing happen. If you really practice, it will happen naturally. So the happiness that you begin to feel as a result of practicing the Dharma and perhaps specifically the ethical life happens quite naturally. You don't have to try and make it happen. Although you can help it along a bit. And one of the ways to help it along is by meditating on your ethical behaviour. There's a practice called Silanusati. Anusati is recollection, remembrance. And Sila is ethical behaviour. So it's a recollection of your own ethical behaviour. And this is actually a practice, a meditation practice. You can just sit and reflect on how ethical you've been recently. And it just makes you feel really happy. It's a really good thing to do, actually. Just think about something that you did for someone recently. Of course, you can do this in an egotistical way and think, oh, that's really good, wasn't I, that I did that? Help that person there. Good for me. Or you can do it in a serious way where you think, that was good, actually. I'm really glad I did that. And then you just begin to feel happier. And there's another meditation practice called Dananusati, and Dana is generosity. Where you meditate on your generosity. Just think of the last time you gave somebody something. Yeah, it might have been a present, birthday present, or it might have been more spontaneous. You just helped someone out in some way, in a way that you didn't have to. It was beyond the call of duty, as we say in Britain. Beyond what you really needed to do. But you just decided, yeah, I'll do that. You might have seen someone in the street and they're looking a bit confused. And you go up and say, you're lost. Yeah, I don't know where I am. And then you say, oh, well, you're here. Oh, you need to go. And then, you know, it just makes life easier for them. And then you can just meditate on that. Can you imagine just doing that? Do 10 minutes mindfulness of breathing and then just meditate on some generous things that you've done recently. It just makes you feel happier. Independence stumbles on joy. Then comes rapture or ecstasy. I used to think my spiritual life stopped about there. Because I couldn't relate to this word, rapture or ecstasy. It sounded so... I thought, well, I've never had that. I've never experienced that. But now I realise I was looking for the wrong thing. You know when you're watching a movie? How many people like watching movies? Everyone, okay. Or if you're really involved in a novel, a really good novel, yeah. And then it gets to a bit. There's always a bit, isn't there, in a film or a novel, where it's almost like things turn around in some way, or it comes to some kind of climax. And you know, you're so involved in it. You don't even realise you're watching a movie anymore. Yeah, you're just there in it. And then this thing happens. And you're moved. Yeah, you're moved. What's that mean? What is that, being moved? Something inside shifts, doesn't it? There's some kind of shift. I've begun to think that what's happening is you're becoming bigger than you can manage. Yeah. You are who you are. You've got used to yourself. You know your boundaries. You know what you can do and what you can't do. But actually, you're bigger than that. We try to keep ourselves within our identity because that makes us safe. But when we're moved, it's almost like we're trying to get out of that identity, because in the end, our identity confines us. It keeps us in this small space. And when we're moved, it's almost like our inner being is saying, let me out of here. You're too small for me. I need a bigger space. And when you're moved, you're out of control. You're no longer in control of the situation. And men, including myself, when I watch movies, when this happens, there's this... Whereas if I'm with a woman, she's like... But I'm sort of... like this. And what's happening is my being just wants to flow and come out like this. And I'm scared of it. I'm scared of that happening. Because I'm getting out of control. So I think this is what this really means. This is rapture. And I think in a way, sometimes the rapture isn't always enjoyable. Yeah. Sometimes that shift. Sometimes we cry. It's almost like sometimes the new self needs to come out in a way which is actually quite painful and difficult. There's a poem by David White, and I think I know this one off by heart, so let's see if I can do it. When your eyes are tired, the world is tired also. When your vision has gone, no part of the world can find you. Time to go into the dark, where the night has eyes to recognize its own. There, you will find a horizon further than you can see. The dark will be your home tonight. There, you can be sure you are not beyond love. You must learn one thing. You must learn one thing. The world was made to be free in. Give up all the other worlds to which you do not belong. Sometimes it takes darkness. Sometimes it takes darkness and the sweet confinement of your aloneness to learn. Anything or anyone that does not bring you alive is too small for you. This poem seems to me to be a poem about confinement, the confinement of being who we are day by day, and the desire to move beyond that confinement. It's quite interesting, he starts off with, when your eyes are tired, the world is tired also. It's true, isn't it? When you're a bit jaded, the world looks jaded, it's grey, nothing interests you. But then he says something interesting. When your vision has gone, no part of the world can find you. No part of the world can find you. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And I find this myself. If my vision has gone, if I'm tired, if I'm jaded, I'm quite hard to reach, actually. You know, notice this with my then-girlfriend. Well, many of my then-girlfriends trying to reach me. Ratnaguna, where are you? I'm fine. And hard to reach. Time to go into the dark where the night has eyes to recognize its own. So it's time to turn inwards. And when you turn inwards, there's a kind of recognition, isn't there? Sometimes it's a bit like a coming home to oneself. There's this sense of, oh, here I am, where the night has eyes to recognize its own. There you will find a horizon further than you can see. Yeah, you can't see the horizon, but it's dark. It's further than you can possibly imagine. You're bigger than you think you are. The dark will be your home tonight. There you can be sure you are not beyond love. When no part of the world can find you, you are beyond love. Yeah, you are keeping everything out. But here, when you go into the dark, you are not beyond love. You are reachable once again. You must learn one thing. The poet David White, I've got a CD of him talking about poetry, and he talks about this poem. And he says, when he got to this line, you must learn one thing. The hairs on the back of his neck stood on end because he didn't know what that thing was when he wrote it. You must learn one thing. The world was made to be free in. That's why we're here, to be free. As long as we're confining ourselves in various ways, then we'll never really be happy. Yeah. The world was made to be free in. Give up all the other worlds to which you do not belong. Give up all those other worlds which are too small for you. All those situations that you've got yourself in where you've acted habitually over and over and over again. And now people expect you to be that person again and again and again. And it's, you know how sometimes a new situation can be so exciting because you can be a new person? I used to do this a lot. I used to leave a situation, go into a new situation just so I could be a new person once again. But a few weeks later, I was the same person I was before, only in this new situation. So then I'd leave and go to a new place, new me, new Ratnaguna. And then I'd revert back to the way I was. And it took a few times. And then somebody said, are you leaving again? I said, yeah. And then she questioned, you know, whether that was a good idea. And I have to admit that she was right, that I had to become a new person here in this situation. Sometimes it takes confinement and the sweet aloneness. Sometimes it takes darkness and the sweet confinement of your aloneness to learn. Anything or anyone that does not bring you alive is too small for you. And he talks about this last line because it can sound a bit harsh. Anyone that does not bring you alive is too small for you. And what you said was, it's not the person who's too small for you, but the habitual relationship you've got into them that is too small for you. So there's this sense, I think, throughout the poem of needing to go within, go inside, to find a bigger space. So this is all connected, in my mind anyway, with rapture, because with rapture what's happening is you're becoming more deeply happy. And as you become more deeply happy, what happens is you start to experience more depths in yourself. And what happens is that things are released. Sangharakshita calls this tension release, which is a very, very prosaic, not very nice way of thinking about rapture or ecstasy, but there's something in that. There's a kind of release of tension. And what is the tension? The tension is one of holding ourselves together to be the person we feel safe to be. So what happens here is we're beginning to let go and we begin to be moved more easily. We're watching a movie and more often we get to that point where there's a sense of releasing in our heart and an opening up in our heart, and it's almost like a longing for openness and freedom and love. So rapture or ecstasy. And then that leads to, perhaps a little bit disappointingly, to calming down. Calm down. I've always thought that was a bit disappointing, really, after rapture and ecstasy. It's just like, wow, how much better can it get? Well, it can't. Then we start to calm down. But remember, these are different degrees of happiness. There's even more happy than that. It's as if from this point of view, that's all just a little bit too excitable. Yeah? It's a little bit like, you know, when you've got children around and they get really excited. Wow, daddy, daddy, can we do this? And you can get into it for a while, can't you? You know, you can play like a kid for half an hour maybe, mess around, roll on the floor, and then after a while you feel, that's enough now, actually. But it's not enough for them. Oh, but daddy, we can do this. And then, and it's just like, oh, please. And it's like, you need to move on. And after a while of rapture, how long that rapture lasts really depends on each person. It can last just for a short while. Sometimes it can just go on for a long, long time. But eventually, you feel a need to just calm, become calm and find a kind of serenity. So here, we're beginning to become serene. There's a kind of serene happiness. In other words, we're finding a deeper happiness in life. Yeah. You could say that these two are kind of dependent. They're dependent on faith. This is dependent upon faith. Joy is dependent upon faith. And rapture is dependent upon joy. And they're dependent upon you carrying on doing certain things and so on. But in the end, we have to become independent. Our happiness needs to become independent of circumstances. This is really what we're aiming for in terms of happiness. We're trying to become happy where it's not really possible to be happy. Yeah, where most people would not be able to be happy. Where you don't really mind what happens. You don't mind about your living situation. You just have this inner sense of happiness. You know, Buddhism has this quite strong streak in it of renunciation, of giving up the world, giving up material possessions, giving up pleasures, giving up sexual relationships, giving up security. And it can look from the outside like a very austere, cold kind of life where you've got nothing. But of course, the person who's given everything up hasn't got nothing. They couldn't possibly live if they had nothing. It would be awful. They're able to give all that up because they've got something else. They've got a deeper, inner kind of happiness. And when you've got that, you really don't need anything else. It's not some kind of heroic, oh, I'd love all those things, but I'm not going to have them. You can do that for a short while, but eventually you'll go back to them. It's more a kind of, you know, I'm okay. I really don't need that new iPhone. Sorry, everybody. I really don't need all those things that they're trying to sell me out there. I'm fine, thank you, I'm happy. So there's this kind of inner happiness. And the reason that people are able to give things up is because there's a sense of inner richness and inner abundance. And that's what's beginning to happen here. There's a deepening of one's happiness. And this leads to sukha. Now, last week, we talked about dukkha and sukha, didn't we? And we talked about the fact that you've got, you're in a state of dukkha. And you don't want to be in a state of dukkha. So you try to jump into sukha instead. You try to leap from there to there. Don't want to be in pain or unhappy. So you try to leap into sukha, but you never actually manage it. What you do is you leap into nowhere. When you try to get away from your own suffering, then what happens is you just end up in a state of resistance to life. I won't go into that now because I went into it in a bit more depth last week. So, here we are. Sukha is the opposite of dukkha. There's something important about all this, which I haven't said yet, which is you never leave anything behind. When you move from dukkha to faith, you haven't left dukkha behind. When you go from faith to joy, you haven't left joy behind. There's a deepening. There's a deepening. So your awareness of dukkha deepens as you go through this. So you're happy. In England, there's a Christian revival kind of movement going on, the evangelists. And people who don't like that kind of thing call it happy clappy. Have you come across that idea? Happy clappy, we're all happy. And their songs are all in the major key. You know, you can always tell a Christian song because it's in a major key. No. And they're all happy clappy. And you can't, maybe this is me again, but I can't help thinking, I don't believe it actually. I don't really believe it. And what I like about this is that you take all this with you. As you go on, your faith is deepening, but so is your awareness and your insight into dukkha. So when you come to sukha, it's not the opposite of dukkha. It's brought dukkha along with it. So here, sukha doesn't just mean ordinary happiness or pleasure. It means a deep sense of fulfillment and purpose. Yeah? It's that sense of, one of my favourite phrases is a life well lived. It's that sense that you get when you know that you're living your life well. You're doing your best. You're confronting what you need to confront. And you're being ethical. And you're doing exactly what you need to do to live as a human being. It's that deep sense of fulfillment and purposeful living. So it's not a kind of happy, clappy happiness. You may not even look particularly happy to others, but there's a kind of warm inner glow. When I was in Dublin recently, I went to the National Gallery, and the painting, there's always usually one painting out of a whole gallery that really hits me. This one was by an Irish woman painter called Helen Mabel Trevor. And it was called The Fisherman's Wife. And it's a painting about this size. And it was a fisherman's wife. Dark clothing, black clothes. You know how they do Catholics wear black clothing. She had a kind of headscarf on. And she was looking straight at the viewer, and her hands were resting on a walking stick, and there was a mala, a rosary bead, hanging from one of her fingers. She's looking up at the viewer like this, and because she's looking up, you can't quite tell whether she's smiling or not. It's hard to say, but very, very lined, old face. But her eyes, looking straight at you, very bright. And this sort of glow coming from her, glow you can't help feeling of a life well lived. I really would like to look like that when I'm old. I really would like to be able to have that kind of face when I'm old. Old, lined, but beautiful. This sense of joy and beauty and happiness, but hard won. You know, the kind of thing. And this is what we're getting to here. It's not a kind of superficial happiness. It's hard won. It's a happiness from living a life well lived and understanding. It's the happiness born of more and more understanding. And it leads to absorption. Samadhi. And what this really means is a sense of wholeness, sense of completeness as a human being, nothing left out, yeah, nothing denied, the whole of you present. As D.H. Lawrence says, last line of his poem, Thought, a man in his wholeness wholly attending, or a woman in her wholeness wholly attending, fully present. the Buddha once used to be called the elephant. And sometimes it would he'd give what was sometimes called the elephant look. And the elephant look is apparently when elephants look, they don't look like that. They turn their whole body round to look. So the whole of their being is looking at you. So, and you know, last week I talked, was it last week? Can't remember now. Been so many talks while I've been here. But all this isn't just for us. Yeah, isn't just for the individual practitioner. When we begin to reach these stages, it's really good for other people. Because if you are deeply happy in yourself, not dependent upon external conditions, but from a deep well of happiness, and you are fully present, what a gift to the world. What a wonderful gift to the world to be able to be there. It was on the retreat, it wasn't here, I talked about that, that's right. And you know when you're in trouble, how many of you have been in trouble in the past? Or when you're really distressed and you really need someone, if not to talk to, just someone to be with, you'll gravitate to someone who's got this. Last week I recited the poem Kindness and Naomi Shihab Nye, and one of the poems, one of the lines is the tender gravity of kindness. The tender gravity of kindness. So this is what we're beginning to get onto here. This is a state of tenderness, but depth. So this is deep happiness, which can't just be grabbed at. You can't get this any old how. You can only get it through many years of work. But once you've got it, once you possess that kind of happiness, then what a gift to the world. Because when you are in trouble, those are the kind of people it's good to be with. Then that leads to wisdom. Oh. Change colour. Wisdom. It's almost wisdom itself, actually. And what happens is, you're emotionally wise before your brain catches up with that. Yeah. Very often it's the other way around, isn't it? We know more than we really live. You know, I know all about the Eightfold Path and the Threefold Way, and I can tell you all about Buddhism. But I don't really live it very well yet. But here, your emotions and the way you live go beyond your understanding. And then later on, you understand what it is you've been doing all these years. Your understanding catches up with the way you've been living. At first, you're just living like that because it's just the way to live. And bit by bit, you begin to understand what it is you've been doing, the significance that your life has taken these past few years. You didn't fully understand it before, but bit by bit, you begin to understand the significance of all these experiences. I'll stop soon because we'd had no time for questions last week. So then comes, I can't quite remember whether it's dispassion or withdrawal, so I'm making sure we get it right. It's withdrawal. Then we withdraw. This is really a furtherance, a sort of going a bit further than here. When here there's always already some withdrawing, because it's here you begin to feel this deep well of happiness springing up within you. And so you don't really need anything in the world. The trinkets, the cars, no, I don't need them. But here it becomes really very deeply embedded in your being that you really want nothing. And now there's a kind of an understanding to that. You want nothing, you understand that nothing can really satisfy in the way that this does. So now you withdraw. Not that you particularly withdraw from other people, but it's more like you withdraw from worldly activity. Yeah. And then that leads to, let's start up here, dispassion. Which is the further degree of that. Of course, in the this is from a very early Buddhist text. And in the early Buddhist text, the Buddha didn't really emphasize compassion in the way that later Buddhism did. So you have to kind of read between the lines. Dispassion is compassion. Because you now want nothing from the world. You don't need anything from the world. So all that's happening now is you're giving to the world. Yeah? You don't want anything back. You're just giving to the world. So that's dispassion, and that leads to freedom. And as we all know, freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Now you're completely free. Yeah? There's something I should have said earlier, that now you've gone beyond pleasure and pain. You've even gone beyond happiness and unhappiness. Yeah? That deep happiness has turned into a sense of equanimity, a sense of deep kind of a kind of ground of being where nothing can shake you, completely unshakable. And that leads, in turn, to enlightenment. I used to think that, as I say, when we got here, my spiritual life stopped about there. Occasionally had a bit of joy and then went back to dukkha. But more recently, I've been thinking, actually, no, that's not true. That isn't true. I think we all do experience all these things, but we mustn't think that they're going to be overwhelming and conscious. That, you know, you get to rapture and it's like, whoa, like this all the time. For some people who I've known, it has been like that. It's almost like their heart opens so much, it's like overwhelming all the time. But some people are quite quiet. And their experience, their happiness, is a quiet kind of happiness. And the rapture is quite quiet. You have to be very, very sensitive to it. The Second Noble Truth says that pain and suffering is caused by, the origin of pain and suffering is craving. And I said, sometimes that's true, but often it's not. Not all our pain and suffering is caused by our craving. Not directly, anyway. And the resolution to that problem is that what the Buddha said was craving causes rebirth, and when you get reborn with everything, including the pain and suffering. So indirectly, it causes pain and suffering. But let's not go back to last week's talk. Let's stay with this. Yes, it was really my theme last week. It was exactly what you're talking about. And there's a line in a book by Breath by Breath by Larry Rosenberg where he talks about the paradox of meditation, he calls it, but you could also call it the paradox of change. Which is, we're at A, and we want to get to B. And sometimes that can be done in the outside world. You want to change the colour of your bedroom, so you go and get the paint, and you do that. But when it comes to inner change, it doesn't work. So what the paradox is, if you want to get from A to B, you have to really be at A. You have to really be at A and be there and accept it and investigate it and see what it's really like to be there. And then you find yourself at B, but not because you've been trying to get there, but because you've just been there where you are. So, yeah. So the whole thing here was people who come on our pain courses, what they've been trying to do for many years is get out of there into there, in many, many different ways, but it's not possible. It was simply not possible to do that if you've got pain. And what they do instead is they end up in a no man's land where they're resisting their own pain, and by doing that they're resisting just about everything in their life, including their family and loved ones and so on. And what they need to do is learn to be there. And this comes as part of the package. Yeah. Yeah. In that way, I think the advertising industry is unethical. Because it's okay to say this is on sale and it's a good thing. But what they do as well as that, they always show young, happy people. As if you had that, there's a kind of a message that I'll somehow be young and happy and successful if I had that thing. I think that's quite unethical. Yeah. And it causes unreal expectations. Yeah. Quite a serious business, happiness and pleasure, isn't it? In fact, I think one of my little things is I think popular culture, although it can be quite cheerful and make you feel quite happy sometimes, on the whole, it prevents people from going deeper into themselves. So in the end, it prevents deeper happiness. So I'm completely against the BBC in Britain having Radio 1 and Radio 2. I really don't think that they should be doing that, because what's happening is people are just trying to be cheerful all the time. Hey, how are you doing? I'm fine. Yeah. And nobody's fine all the time. You can't be. But as long as you're listening to Radio 1 all day, you will never find that confront. You will never confront your deeper inner self, and therefore you'll never be able to really find deeper happiness.